Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We are up to Book 4, Chapter 4, and we're in the middle of a pretty big party, so let's kick on with it. Pierre sat opposite Dolokhov and Nicholas Rostov. As usual, he ate and drank much and eagerly. But those who knew him intimately noticed that some great change had come over him that day. He was silent all through dinner and looked about, blinking and scowling with fixed eyes and a look of complete absent-mindedness, kept rubbing the bridge of his nose. His face was depressed and gloomy. He seemed to see and hear nothing of what was going on around him and to be absorbed by some depressing and unsolved problem. The unsolved problem that tormented him was caused by hints given by the princess, his cousin at Moscow, concerning Dolokhov's intimacy with his wife, and by an anonymous letter he had received that morning, which in the mean, jocular way common to anonymous letters, said that he saw badly through his spectacles, but that his wife's connection with Dolokhov was a secret to no one but himself. Pierre absolutely disbelieved both the princess's hints and the letter, but he feared now to look at Dolokhov, who was sitting opposite him. Every time he chanced to meet Dolokhov's handsome, insolent eyes, Pierre felt something terrible and monstrous rising in his soul and turned quickly away. Involuntarily recalling his wife's past and her relations with Dolokhov, Pierre saw clearly that what was said in the letter might be true, or might at least seem to be true, had it not referred to his wife. He involuntarily remembered how Dolokhov, who had fully recovered his former position after the campaign, had returned to Petersburg and come to him. Availing himself of his friendly relations with Pierre as a boon companion, Dolokhov had come straight to his house, and Pierre had put him up and lent him money. Pierre recalled how Helena had smilingly expressed disapproval of Dolokhov's living at their house, and how cynically Dolokhov had praised his wife's beauty to him, and from that time till they came to Moscow had not left them for a day. "Yes, he is very handsome," thought Pierre, "and I know him. It would be particularly pleasant to him to dishonour my name and ridicule me, just because I have exerted myself on his behalf, befriended him and helped him. I know and understand what a spice that would add to the pleasure of deceiving me, if it really were true. Yes, if it were true, but I do not believe it. I have no right to, and can't believe it." He remembered the expression Dolokhov's face assumed in his moments of cruelty, as when tying the policeman to the bear and dropping them into the water, or when he challenged a man to a duel without any reason, or shot a postboy's horse with a pistol. That expression was often on Dolokhov's face when looking at him. "Yes, he is a bully," thought Pierre. "To kill a man means nothing to him. It must seem to him that everyone is afraid of him, and that must please him. He must think that I too am afraid of him, and in fact I am afraid of him," he thought. And again he felt something terrible and monstrous rising in his soul. Dolokhov, Denisov, and Rostov were now sitting opposite Pierre and seemed very gay. Rostov was talking merrily to his two friends, one of whom was a dashing hussar and the other a notorious duelist and rake. And every now and then he glanced ironically at Pierre, whose preoccupied, absent-minded and massive figure was a very noticeable one at the dinner. Rostov looked inimically at Pierre, first because Pierre appeared to his hussar eyes as a rich civilian, the husband of a beauty, and in a word, an old woman, and secondly because Pierre, in his preoccupation and absent-mindedness, had not recognized Rostov and had not responded to his greeting. When the Emperor's health was drunk, Pierre, lost in thought, did not rise or lift his glass. "What are you about?" shouted Rostov, looking at him in an ecstasy of exasperation. "Don't you hear it's His Majesty the Emperor's health?" Pierre sighed, rose submissively, emptied his glass and, waiting till all was seated again, turned with his kindly smile to Rostov. "Why, I didn't recognize you," he said. But Rostov was otherwise engaged. He was shouting hurrah. "Why don't you renew the acquaintance," said Dolokhov to Rostov. "Confound him, he's a fool," said Rostov. "One should make up to the husbands of pretty women," said Denisov. Pierre did not catch what they were saying, but knew they were talking about him. He reddened and turned away. "Well, now to the health of handsome women," said Dolokhov, and with a serious expression but with a smile lurking at the corners of his mouth, he turned with his glass to Pierre. "Here's to the health of lovely women, Petekin, and their lovers," he added. Pierre, with downcast eyes, drank out of his glass without looking at Dolokhov or answering him. The footman, who was distributing leaflets with Kutuzov's cantata, laid one before Pierre as one of the principal guests. He was just going to take it when Dolokhov, leaning across, snatched it from his hand and began reading it. Pierre looked at Dolokhov and his eyes dropped. The something terrible and monstrous that had tormented him all dinner time rose and took possession of him. He leaned his whole massive body across the table. "How dare you take it?" he shouted. Hearing that cry and seeing to whom it was addressed, Nesvitsky and the neighbour on his right quickly turned in alarm to Bezukhov. Don't, what are you about?" whispered their frightened voices. Dolokhov looked at Pierre with clear, mirthful, cruel eyes, and that smile of his which seemed to say, "Ah, this is what I like." "You shan't have it," he said distinctly. Pale, with quivering lips, Pierre snatched the copy. You scoundrel, I challenge you," he ejaculated, and pushing back his chair, he rose from the table. At the very instant he did this and uttered those words, Pierre felt that the question of his wife's guilt, which had been tormenting him the whole day, was finally and indisputably answered in the affirmative. He hated her, and was forever sundered from her. Despite Denisov's request that he would take no part in the matter, Rostov agreed to be Dolokhov's second, and after dinner he discussed the arrangements for the duel with Nesvitsky, Bezukhov's second. Pierre went home, but Rostov, with Dolokhov and Denisov, stayed on at the club till late, listening to the gypsies and other singers. "Well then, till tomorrow, at Sokolniki," said Dolokhov as he took leave of Rostov in the club porch. "And do you feel quite calm?" Rostov asked. Dolokhov paused. "Well, you see, I'll tell you the whole secret of dueling in two words. If you are going to fight a duel, and you make a will and write affectionate letters to your parents, and if you think you may be killed, you are a fool, and you are certain to lose. But go with the firm intention of killing your man as quickly and surely as possible, and then all will be right. As our bear huntsman at Kostroma used to tell me, everyone fears a bear. He says, but when you see one, your fear's all gone, and your only thought is not to let him get away. And that's how it is with me. A demain, monsieur." Next day, at 8 in the morning, Pierre and Nesvitsky drove to the Sokolinki forest and found Dolokhov, Denisov and Rostov already there. Pierre had the air of a man preoccupied with considerations which had no connection with the matter in hand. His haggard face was yellow. He had evidently not slept that night. He looked about distractedly and screwed up his eyes, as if dazzled by the sun. He was entirely absorbed by two considerations: his wife's guilt, of which after his sleepless night he had not the slightest doubt, and the guiltlessness of Dolokhov, who had no reason to preserve the honour of a man who was nothing to him. "I should perhaps have done the same in his place," thought Pierre. "It's even certain that I should have done the same. Then why this duel, this murder? Either I shall kill him, or he shall hit me in the head or elbow or knee. Can't I go away from here, run away, and bury myself somewhere? Passed through his mind. But just at moments when such thoughts occurred to him, he would ask in a particularly calm and absent-minded way, which inspired the respect of onlookers, "Will it be long? Are things ready?" When all was ready, the sabres stuck in the snow to mark the barriers and the pistols loaded, Nesvitsky went up to Pierre. "I should not be doing my duty, Count," he said in timid tones, "and should not justify your confidence and your honour you have done me in choosing me for your second, if at this grave, this very grave moment, I did not tell you the whole truth. I think there is no sufficient ground for this affair, or for blood to be shed over it. You were not right, not quite in the right. You were impetuous." "Oh, yes, it's horribly stupid," said Pierre. "Then allow me to express your regrets, and I am sure your opponent will accept them," said Nesvitsky, who, like the others concerned in the affair, and like everyone in the similar cases, did not yet believe that the affair had come to an actual duel. "You know, Count, it is much more honourable to admit one's mistake than to let matters become irreparable. There was no insult on either side. Allow me to convey." "No. What is there to talk about?" said Pierre. "It's all the same. Is everything ready?" he added. "Only tell me where to go and where to shoot," he said with an unnaturally gentle smile. He took the pistol in his hand and began asking about the working of the trigger, as he had not before held a pistol in his hand, a fact he did not wish to confess. "Oh, yes, like that. I know, I only forgot," said he. "No apologies, none whatsoever," said Dolokhov to Denisov, who on his side had been attempting a reconciliation, and he also went up to the appointed place. The spot chosen for the duel was some 80 paces from the road, where the sledges had been left, in a small clearing in the pine forest, covered by melting snow, the frost having begun to break up during the last few days. The antagonists stood 40 paces apart, at the farther edge of the clearing. The seconds, measuring the paces, left tracks in the deep wet snow between the place where they had been standing and Nesvitsky's and Dolokhov's sabres, which were stuck into the ground 10 paces apart to mark the barrier. It was thawing and misty at 40 paces distance. Nothing could be seen. For 3 minutes all had been ready, but they still delayed, and all were silent. Well, that's a cliffhanger of an end of a chapter, if ever I've read one. All right, there we have it. Another chapter down. Oh, how can we not read on? This is one of those moments where, you know, one chapter per day is very tantalizing. You know, as a writer, you're aware of, you know, different tricks, or not tricks, different techniques that can be used, different things in the tool set of writing. And, you know, the cliffhanger ending like that. And the nice short chapters. I did note just now that the next chapter is only a page and a half long. You know, if it was late at night and I'd been reading past my bedtime and I just got to this point, and if I wasn't doing the one chapter per day thing, there's no way I wouldn't stay up a little bit later past my bedtime and read that next 1.5 pages. And it's interesting to note that this technique, you know, it existed at least as far back as 1860 when this book was written. I think it was written in 1860 or around there. For some reason, in my uneducated brain, I just assume that these things are modern and, you know, the fact that I know them is that I'm up to speed with the latest and greatest techniques of writing novels. As it turns out, Tolstoy was about 150 years ahead of me in that game. Now, you've heard me say this a few times, but I hope it's not losing its weight when I say it, but this is the most I've wanted to read on at the end of a chapter. It's set a new record for wanting to read on-ness. I think it's partly because I don't want either of these characters to die, and I suppose I don't really know the rules of a duel. I mean, they've only got old-fashioned pistols, So they get one shot each, unless they, you know, take their shots and then go and reload their guns. But I'm pretty sure you only get a shot with those old-fashioned pistols. And I guess they shoot at each other from a distance. And, well, if they take their shots and miss, which is probably pretty likely because those old pistols weren't very accurate, then is that it? Like, is there a potential that no one gets hurt? Or a potential that maybe one of them just gets, like, shot in the leg or something and then that settles it sort of thing? I don't know. Shadow Velster said, "During this chapter, we are shown that Pierre thinks of the look that Dolokhov gets when he challenges someone for a duel. We also see that Dolokhov reveals his secret for a duel, and that Pierre doesn't know how to use a pistol. If you think that Pierre will win the duel, do you think Tolstoy showed these things to emphasize that Pierre doesn't stand a chance, and therefore when he wins, it will come much more of a surprise? Do you think this can be called situational irony?" That's a good question. Yeah, it does seem, well, he's setting it up to make sure the reader knows that, you know, Dolokhov is known for winning duels, and Pierre doesn't know how to use a gun. So if Pierre comes out on top from this, it would certainly be unlikely. And it could be, maybe setting it up, you know, it's the old bait and switch sort of thing. It would be pretty cool to see, you know, you always like to see the underdog. And I think I do like Pierre more than I like Dolokhov, so I'm kind of rooting for him. I've been saying from the start that I like Dolokhov, and I do. But this chapter, especially the early part of this chapter, when seeing him through Pierre's eyes, and he points out that he's a bully and that he's quite cruel, it made me, yeah, dislike him a little bit. Yeah, he did come across as a bully, and I didn't realize about the cruelty and that look in his eye when he's doing something like that. And then, you know, he slept with the guy's wife, and now he's taunting him about it. He's kind of gone over the edge from, like, you know, a bit cheeky and a bit of a trickster and a bad boy to being genuinely kind of a bad dude. So I am on Team Pierre. I do feel like it's one of those setting it up, like Tolstoy's making a point of you know, how good Dolokhov is with a gun and how bad Pierre is. I don't know. It would be highly unlikely for Pierre to win, I think. Now, the other question, do you think this can be called situational irony? There's a little link there explaining what exactly that is, which I will go through now. Situational irony is a literary device that you can easily identify in literary works. Simply, it occurs when incongruity appears between expectations of something to happen and what actually happens instead. Thus, sometimes entirely different things happen from what audiences may be expecting, or the final outcome is opposite to that which the audience expects. Situational irony generally includes sharp contrasts and contradictions. The purpose of ironic situations is to allow the readers to make a distinction between appearances and reality and the eventuality associated to them, to the theme of the story. There's some examples here, such as The Wonderful Wizard of Oz presents a case for situational irony. Dorothy goes to the wizard in order to find a way home, only to learn that she is capable of doing so herself. She also learns that the wizard is not actually magical, which I guess is sort of ironic. Scarecrow wishes to become intelligent, but discovers himself a perfect genius. Woodsman, which is Tin Man, considers himself as not capable of love, but nevertheless he learns that he has a good heart. Lion appears as a coward and turns out to be extremely fearless and courageous. Right. I think this is slightly different from that, this situation here. I think, like, it wouldn't be a twist if Pierre won. It would be unexpected, but it wouldn't, you know, it's a possibility. Everyone reading knows it's a possibility that Pierre might win. So it's not, I don't think it's that completely out of the blue this happened. It's in line with believability, I suppose. It's, you know, stories have this, writing a story from a writer's point of view, you need to remember that whole life, is stranger than fiction. truth is stranger than fiction, sorry, because really unexpected things have a tendency to happen in life. It's kind of the ergodic hypothesis, you know. It's extremely unlikely that as I say this, there isn't something completely bizarre and unexplainable happening on planet Earth somewhere. Because there's so many billions of things happening that the likelihood that at least some of those things are, you know, unexplainable is very high. There's got to be some bizarre things happening at all times. So you've got to remember that when you write fiction. And it's also, you've got to remember that a story is a story because unexpected things happened. If a story is just everything went as planned and everything went as expected, it's not much of a story. So we tend to tell stories in real life about the things that are unexpected or unexplainable. I don't know. it's all wishful thinking. Like, I really want Pierre to win, but I'd settle for him just being injured and that being the end of it. As long as he doesn't die, I'm happy. If Dolokhov dies, that would suck. There's also the point that I am aware that Pierre's a main character in the book, and I just don't think that he's going to check out so soon in the book. But then again, I thought the same thing of Prince Andrew, so... Oh no, I'm just second-guessing everything. I cannot wait till tomorrow. Let's go through some comments, eh? Puffle Huffy said, "Okay, be honest. Who else just pushed through and read the next chapter?" Oh dear, it seems that no one could wait. Elvis Von Fond said, "I resisted, though the urge was very, very strong, and I can't wait for tomorrow." Wiggity Wack said, "Yeah, I did. Now I don't feel like I can comment to you." Mag019 said, "I held off for about an hour, and then caved and read the next chapter." Austin Fan said, "Absolutely, I had to read the next two." Who Was Once Delight said, "Yep." And Obi-Wan Spicoli said, "I did too. I couldn't help myself." It was a cliffhanger. And it seems that I'm the only person here, well, me and Elvis Von Fons, with any integrity. Or willpower, let's call it willpower. Libby Stitch has said, "I can probably recite the whole Hamilton soundtrack off by heart, so it was fun to see that the 10 Dual Commandments were a worldwide standard at the time. If you don't know the track, here's a link." I'll put a link to this song in the description for this episode. "That being said, I really don't understand dueling. It just seems like such a waste of life over hurt feelings and slights on character, to the extent that it makes me quite angry. I've got no idea how Pierre's going to get out of this one, though I guess I'm pleased that he actually has stood up for himself for once, even if it might get him killed / maimed." In response, Puffle Huffy said, quoting, "It just seems like such a waste of life over hurt feelings and slights of character. The fragile male ego is a hell of a thing." I've also got this feeling, like, you can't just shoot one of the richest dudes in the country, can you? Like, I just feel like, doesn't Pierre's wealth protect him somehow? Again, that's probably wishful thinking. It was interesting to see Nikolai Rostov's attitude towards Pierre. He now sees him as just a kind of high society, useless person. You know, he didn't go to war and he's rich, and Rostov doesn't look kindly on Pierre anymore, or if he ever did. I had the feeling like, oh, come on, if you just get to know Pierre, he's not all bad. All right, I'm going to keep this one short because I'm aware that in the future when people binge listen through this podcast, they'll get to this episode, they'll probably skip the discussion part because they want to know what happens next. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.